Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Connecting Faith. You can hear the show live each weekday at noon Central Time, and there are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows available online. Our web address is myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Welcome to Connecting Faith, and it's an honor today to spend some time with Dr. Henry Cloud. You certainly know of him. He's a leadership consultant, a best-selling author, speaker. His books have sold over 7 million copies, both a psychologist and a student of the spiritual life, and has written over 20 books. Of course, the multi-million seller Boundaries series, several that have really impacted me, and I recommend it to you, 9 Things You Simply Must Do. Integrity, Necessary Endings, and the One Life Solution. I want to talk about one that he's just released. It's called Never Go Back, 10 Things You'll Never Do Again. And I always appreciate Henry's writing. And this one, it seemed maybe more so than ever, seemed like it had a lot of proverbs and just spiritual insight into it. I know, Henry, that's... I know you write business books and speak, but I know you certainly have a heart for communicating the truth of God's word as well, don't you?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of an interesting thing. I'm a believer, and I'm a psychologist and a leadership consultant. And what happened was I had written a number of books that talked about how the spiritual life and faith development affects the areas of life that psychologists tend to deal with, like our clinical problems, depressions and anxieties and addictions, and then our relationship issues and performance stuff. But I do most of my work is with leaders in the field of leadership and CEOs and, people that lead organizations. And what would happen was, when I go into the workplace, believers there would like to take my books in, but they couldn't because, they would quote all the verses. So I decided to start writing my business books that had all of that thinking in it. Certainly God's created order for everything, but just leave the addresses of the verses out, and then that solved the problem.
This book is about... It's addressing something that we're all too familiar with most of the time. It's about making mistakes, and sometimes big ones, sometimes small ones, and you're sharing some doorways to success for never going back. In fact, speaking of sort of religious terms, I know you wanted to use the term repent as maybe a title for the book. But talk about what the book is all about.
Well, it's interesting. I've got a fun job. I get to watch really high performers in all areas of life and work with them. And what I noticed was people that do really well, in their careers or professions, in business, and in the areas of relationships, they, in some ways, they're really not that different, as people from other people that, kind of stay stuck and can't make it work. But there is one huge difference. While everybody tends to have kind of the same issues in some ways and the same, struggles, what successful people do is there's one thing they do different, and that is they actually notice that they really don't have problems. They have patterns. Hmm. And it's their patterns that are really creating the problems. And once they get that and they wake up, they go through these awakenings. It's like mental puberty. They go through a doorway, never to return to the old way they used to do it. And then they have a whole new course, in that direction. And so I just got really fascinated by these kind of, awakenings or wake-up calls or doorways or changes people would make that they never go back. And so about 6 or 8 years ago, I started just watching them and researching them and recording them. And here, 6 years later, I dump them all out on my desk and they fell into 10 piles because there's these 10 that kept recurring of 10 wake-up calls that successful people have learned that one, and they never do it again.
Well, and we'll get to maybe as many as we can on those, but I know that, you know, just setting up the topic, that this isn't necessarily talking about second chances, or that it's different than I guess just a second chance at doing the same old thing.
Right, it is. And back to your, you know, the question about the repent word. You know, if you keep walking into a wall, you know, finally, it's probably a good idea to say, you know, maybe I should go a different way, right? Maybe I should turn around and go in a different direction. And that's really what the word repent means. It means, you know, change your mind, turn your direction, go a different route. And so I thought, you know, repent has kind of gotten a bad rap, you know. People think it's this, like, negative word. And so I said, I'm going to bring repentance back to being a popular word, and I'm going to write a book called I Repent, 10 Things I'll Never Do Again. And so I start, you know, I call the publisher and said, you know, this is what I want to write. And the publisher just, you know, screamed at me and said, you can't write a book called Repentance. It's too negative. And I go, no, you're crazy. And so I go interviewing people, right? And I'm asking all kinds of people. And everybody I told that I was going to write a book on repentance, they said, no, 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 you can't. That's too negative. No, I would never read that book. And they just would throw up all over the idea. And then they say, what's it about? And I said, well, you know, it's these wake-up calls that really successful people get. And once they figure that out in life, they never go back to their old way of doing it. And they go, oh, I would love to read that book. Hmm. Same idea, different word.
Well, let's flesh the word out in a number of the ways you talk about some of those places where we never want to go back. And I know one of the early ones you talk about is that we have to understand sort of who we are. We can't be who we're not created to be.
Yeah, one of the 10 things is, you know, successful people realize that they'll never go back to trying to be something or somebody that they're not. And what I mean by that is a lot of times, you know, you're going along in life and you want a relationship to work with somebody, or you want a certain job to work, or you want something, you know, a position to work in a career, or this, that, and the other. And you really want kind of the big thing. You want the result. But when you look at the actuality of what it's going to mean day to day that you have to be like, it would really require you to be somebody else, somebody you're not. I mean, I found that when I was, you know, I was an accounting and finance major because I was good in math, and I thought I was going to, my dream was to be in professional golf, and I had a hand injury in college and had to quit, and here I am, an accounting and finance major, which I, you know, was good at, but I went to work in a bank, you know, halfway through college, and I barely made it through the summer. I mean, it just was not who I was, and I ended up, you know, changing my major. Now, that doesn't mean that for seasons there are times we got to buckle down and be somebody we're not to accomplish a goal. But if you're looking at something that's gonna be long term, a job or a relationship or living in a town or whatever it is, and it's just not you. You know, God has made everybody with certain talents and gifts and bents and designs. And you just better, you know, I've heard people say a thousand times, yeah, I learned, that's just not me, and I never try to do that again. And that's when things change. Yeah.
Is, you know, there's, I guess that maybe there's this secondary part to that, is that we do things sometimes to please other people, right? That's
right.
That's what we sort of get caught in that trap.
You know, we do. And, in fact, I was doing a radio interview earlier today, and the host was looking at the list of 10, and he said, gosh, I've got this one, you know. I have to confess, I'm a people pleaser. And I said, well, before you go calling that a sin, you know, let's just try to understand this thing. Do you know that God, that's a good thing. God has wired us all the way to the neurology of how we're glued together. He has wired us to really come alive and thrive and do better when we are around people that are pleased with us, that love us, you know, that are approving of us and are for us. If you look at a little baby, for example, and they can hook their brains up. And if mom or dad or somebody smiles at an infant, the infant's whole being changes. You know, they start having serotonin releases and all this dopamine and all this stuff in their brain. They smile and they start wiggling and everything kind of comes alive. And then you frown at them and the exact same thing happens. They begin to shut down. So having people approve, good and faithful servant, well done, you know, that's a good thing. Here's the problem. The problem is we don't discriminate between who we want to please and who we don't. And if you have the dynamic of thinking that you can please everybody, make everybody happy, then that's a nightmare, because the reality is the world has a lot of different kinds of people in it. And so if you're pleasing really good, honest, responsible, faithful, loving people, that means you're doing some good stuff in life, because they're not going to be pleased with, you know, lying and cheating and stealing and all that. But if you're pleasing control freaks or narcissistic people or self-centered people or people that want to do dark things and you'd have to give up your values to do it, if you're keeping them happy, that's not good. I did a leadership event one time with Tony Blair, and my job was to kind of pull out of him, you know, his views on leadership. And I asked him what were some of the awakenings that he went through as prime minister. And he said, you know, one of the biggest ones, he said, everything changed when I realized that it's just true. It's like math. It's just true that every decision divides. You know, every decision you make, there's some people that want you to choose A, other people want you to choose B, and they're going to like it, and some people aren't going to like it. He said, once you realize that, then you can start really making decisions based on the merit, and you can start playing offense in life instead of defense, and just make sure you upset the right people.
We're hopefully not upsetting you, but we're encouraging you with Henry Cloud's new book. Dr. Henry Cloud is a best-selling author, psychologist, and a business leadership consultant. He's sold over 7 million copies of his books, over 20 books. The new one is called Never Go Back, 10 Things You'll Never Do Again, and he's our guest today on Connecting Faith. Talk today with Dr. Henry Cloud about his brand new book called Never Go Back, 10 Things You'll Never Do Again. We're talking about how we can maybe avoid some of the mistakes that happen to us and take us down the wrong path and find some awakenings and new doorways to success. And Henry, you mentioned a little bit earlier, we're talking about, you know, pleasing other people. And if you're pleasing the wrong kind of people, maybe they're control freaks or narcissists or self-centered. So at the same time, though, as you say, we can't change someone else. That's always kind of hard to hear.
It is hard to hear because, you know, by definition, as being humans wanting to live with other good humans, then when we run into people we want to perform better, we want to change them, right? We want to fix them. And it's people's lives actually just go down a totally different path when they wake up and have the realization that you cannot change another person. Now, let's explain that. That does not mean that you can't be a change agent in somebody's life, that you can't influence them to change, that you can't order circumstances and order your relationship with them in a way that maximizes the probability and the opportunity for them to change. But it does mean that ultimately you can't violate the reality that they have a choice. And what happens is, you know, you see this with parents and kids, you see it with spouses, you see it with bosses, when somebody's not performing, they try to light a fire under their belly and get them motivated and push them and get them to, you know, I've told them to do this and I want you, and how many times do I have to tell you, didn't I tell you to do your homework, and on and on and on and on and on. And try to get somebody sober or try to get somebody, you know, to care about school or and we have a natural kind of tendency to want to do this. But the reality is you can't make anybody do anything. What you can do is you can be a change agent and relate to them in a way where you can order your relationship that makes it in a way that makes it not work in the way that they're being. Like if I'm a boss, I can't make somebody make those sales calls, but I can order my job for them in a way that if they're not making the sales calls, it's not going to work for them. I can do that. And that will highly influence them. But to just try to get somebody to be responsible or get somebody to be motivated or get somebody to be spiritual, and really where we're trying to take control and drive another person's growth, it never works.
You know, we're talking about change. I mean, most of us are, I guess I certainly will say that, reluctant to change because generally, change means, pain and discomfort. And now you address that we prefer the no pain version, which doesn't really work.
Well, it's an interesting paradox. Again, we're kind of in some ways set up for failure in a fallen world because the way God has designed our brains, your brain is actually wired to resist change in a certain way. What I mean by that is you have maps of the way the world works, all right? So if you got in your car this morning and you live in the United States, you start driving to work and somebody's driving down the wrong side of the road like if you're in England or something, then your mind is going to register that as an error, and you're going to blow the horn. You're going to say, foul, I don't want to get back on your side, because we have ways that we're wired to think things work. Now, the problem is that we're wired, because of our experiences in life and in a fallen world, we learn some ways, and we get wired to do relationship in certain ways and performance in certain ways and all of that basically don't work. But we're wired that way. And so that's what you're saying. That's when what you're saying is very, very important, that we realize that, I've really got a choice here. There's two options. I can continue to do this and continue to fail and go through the pain of the consequences of one more broken relationship or one more failed job or one more whatever it is, or I can go through the pain of doing the work that it's going to take to learn some new skills and to change, but the outcome of that path is very different. There's pain involved in both. Pain is unavoidable. The only pain that we can avoid is the pain that comes from trying to avoid pain.
That goes along with, I think, taking in the big picture, right? Not losing the big picture, because that's the same, that's kind of part of the motivation, isn't it?
It really is. One of the things you see that great performers do is when things happen, they just don't react to a situation without looking at the big picture and asking the question, what is it that I'm really trying to accomplish here? When somebody does something that might infuriate us, or really bugs us or something, and you'd want to respond to that, you deal with it in a certain way or whatever, but when you stop for a moment and say, wait a minute, now, this person's going to be my neighbor. They just bought this house. They're going to be living there for 20, 30 years. I gotta look at, we got to live next to each other for a while. Maybe I want to handle this situation a little differently because I'm keeping the big picture in mind. And we really start to orient our choices and our resources and our time and our energy and our efforts very, very differently in little decisions when we keep the big picture in mind.
In the second part of the book, we don't have time to get through all the 10 these 10 doorways to success, but you talk about the now what, and you refer to sort of the wake-up call, and there are a number of ways that we can wake up, and I guess just say a word about how we get started in turning things around.
Well, that's kind of the $64 question, right? And what the big wake-up call is when we recognize that You know, I don't really have a problem here. I think the problem is this, you know, this controlling person that, you know, drives me crazy, or this, you know, whatever it is. What I've got is I've got a pattern in my life of being vulnerable to that kind of person, because these kind of people are everywhere, right? And if I look back, you know, I remember one time I was doing a group, and this lady said, "I get it. I've been married to 9 abusive husbands, and I don't want to do that anymore." And this other lady says, "Mabel, shut up. You hadn't been married to 9 abusive husbands. You've been married to 1 abusive husband with 9 different names." And she recognized, you know, she thought all these men were the problem, and certainly they were problematic, but her problem was she was just attracted to a certain kind of person. And so the wake-up call is realizing that we all have patterns that we need to address. And once you do that, then you have to ask the question, okay, so what do? I just make a New Year's resolution? I'm not going to do that anymore? No, that doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work is that these patterns are hardwired into us, and they're just part of our makeup. And you can't just make a choice. You know, Moses tried that. He came off the hill with 10 choices for people, right? And what the Bible tells us is that that's powerless to change anybody. So we can't just say, well, I'm not going to do that anymore. We must say, I don't want to do that anymore, and then ask the second question of, so what's it going to take for me to ever do that again? And that's when we get to the real revelation that the Bible and all of science affirms. There's no such thing as self-help. You know, you can't say to a car it's out of gas, well, you know, go get some self-gas. It can't. And when we realize that God is the only self-sustaining entity and the rest of us draw everything we need from outside of ourselves, then you bend the knee and you bow to the reality of what I like to call open system change. If you're a closed system trying to just change yourself, it's not going to work. But if you open up to two things, a new energy sources, or, you know, a lot of new energy sources, and new intelligence. So we need fuel, we need energy, and we need intelligence to order that energy, which means you open up to God, you open up to other people, you get support, you get mentoring, you get some coaching, you get some help, then we can change pretty much anything. But it's hard for us to do that second step and then to know, you know, what kind of intelligence and what kind of people we need around us.
Don't do it on your own. Don't buy into the self-help idea, and find some doorways to success in Henry Cloud's new book, Never Go Back, 10 Things You'll Never Do Again. Dr. Henry Cloud, psychologist and a leadership consultant, best-selling author, and the book is just out from Howard Books, called Never Go Back. And we've got a little bonus time with Dr. Henry Cloud coming up in the next half hour, thanks to a recorded interview I did with Dr. Cloud when his book Boundaries for Leaders came out. And you'll find some of the principles important and the same as what we've talked about with Never Go Back. Last year, he released the book Boundaries for Leaders, Results, Relationships, and Being Ridiculously in Charge. And we'll talk about some of those important boundaries. And he argues that understanding the personal and interpersonal side of leadership is every bit as important as vision and execution. And we're going to get some great insight. And by the way, we have a copy of Boundaries for Leaders that we'll make available to you if you'd like to drop us a note via email at myfaithradio.com and click on the Connecting Faith show page, and then just give us your contact information there. We'll do a drawing at the end of the hour for a copy of Boundaries for Leaders, Results, Relationships, and Being Ridiculously in Charge. A little bonus time with Dr. Henry Cloud coming up in a couple of minutes here on Connecting Faith. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. Looking forward to drawing more insight and wisdom from Dr. Henry Cloud as we review one of his great leadership books called Boundaries for Leaders. As I mentioned, Dr. Cloud is a leadership consultant, a best-selling author, and speaker. His books have sold over 7 million copies, all of them recommended reading. Let's jump into the second half discussion here on Connecting Faith with Dr. Henry Cloud.
You've written the book Boundaries, but this new one is Boundaries for Leaders, and
you know, I guess when I think of boundaries, I generally think of it sort of as a restriction. It's sort of what not to do, but you suggested there are really two aspects, two elements to boundaries. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, you know, it's true. They're both positive and negative in a sense, because all a boundary is basically a structure. You know, when you think of a boundary of your property line, if you live in a house or a rent a home or an apartment or whatever, a boundary is a structure that defines what is on the property and what is not on the property, right? So the positive side of that is when people get in charge and begin to realize, you know, what do I want my family to look like? What do I want my business to look like? What do I want my team to look like? There are positive structures that they begin to set up that will create what they want. And then on the negative side, they got to know, what do I not want on this property? And that's where they create the limits and boundaries that say, you know, that's not going to be okay.
And as a leader, we have influence in both of those areas, right?
Absolutely. You know, what's going to happen is, and in the beginning of the book, in the subtitle, it says that you're ridiculously in charge. And that came from a conversation with a CEO that I work with who was saying something like, well, you know, my team, this and that. And I said, well, why is that? And he said, well, you know, the guy that came in and the VP of this and his old company. I said, well, why is that? And I kept saying, well, why is that? And finally he got it. And he looks up and he goes, well, I guess I am ridiculously in charge, right? Meaning, yeah, and whatever you're getting, and here's kind of the point, whatever you're getting, you're either creating or you're allowing it, one of the two. And so in the culture of the team, the vision, the way they're getting results or not getting results, you're either contributing to that or you're allowing it.
I want to talk a little bit more about brain function, because I think you refer to three things, that executive brain function. Talk about those three sort of areas and maybe expand on those a bit.
Oh, this is so important. I wish, you know, we could spend like days on this. But basically, the way that your brain is designed, it basically has this region called that performs what are called executive functions. Now, what that means is, it's everything that has to do with getting anything done. So if you're going to move from A to Z, you're going to accomplish a goal, whatever that goal is. And I mean, even something as simple as your goal is to drive from the radio studio to 7-Eleven, all right? Your brain, to pull that off, it's got to do three things. Number one, it's got to attend to what is relevant. So there's a certain amount of information that it needs to really focus on and be aware of in order for it to pull the triggers that are going to do what you need to do to get there. So it's got to attend to, like, the oncoming traffic, which lane am I in, how fast am I going, did I just hit the brake, or the speedometer is saying this or that, or, you know, where's the next turn. So it's got this set of data that it's got to really pay attention to. Secondly, it's got to inhibit everything else. So you can't be texting, you can't be watching a video, you can't have somebody screaming at you. So it's got to shut that out. And then the third thing is, it's got to keep it current. It needs what's called a working memory. So it's got to know what it just did in order to know what to do next. I can't drop you from a time machine into the driver's seat of the car and you know, you'd panic. You don't know what to do next because you don't know what just happened. You don't know if you hit the brake or the accelerator. And in anything you do, if you're trying to get a kid who's ADD to clean up their room, what you've got to do is structure it where they can attend to what's relevant, inhibit everything else, and keep it current. And if you're trying to get an executive team, if a CEO's running a major corporation, this is what they do. They always try to get clarity and focus of, look, guys, this is what we are going to do. And we're not going to do all this other stuff, and I'm going to keep it in front of you every day. Very important.
Which gets back to sort of the summary of the book, the boundaries for leaders, right? It's what you allow and what you inhibit, right?
Yeah, it's what you create on the positive side and what you allow. And that gives people great room to go create and do incredible things. You know, one of the examples I put in there about that first one is when Steve Jobs came back to Apple. And Apple was, you know, barely had a pulse. I mean, it wasn't even registering anywhere as anything but, you know, a little kind of cult following of some some geeks and nerds. And so he goes there, and he starts walking the halls, and he's noticing there's 30 something versions of the Mac. And so he starts asking a question, and here was his question. So if I want to tell my cousin to buy one, which one do I tell him to buy? And he just couldn't get his arms around all of the confusion. So then one day in a meeting, he just screams, "This is crazy." He goes over to the board. He draws a box with four quadrants in it. Across the top, he writes personal and professional. Across the side, down the side, he writes portable and desktop. That leaves you four options. He said, "That's what we're going to do. We're going to make four Macs, not 30-something. And if you go in a store today, that's what you find. You find four different Macs." And all of, you know, all of our lives are like that, that if we don't get clarity on something that we're really about, or the few things that we're about, then all your gifts and talents won't be able to be that scattered and lack of focus and pull it off.
Talking today with Dr. Henry Cloud, his new book is called Boundaries for Leaders. The subtitle is Results, Relationships, and Being Ridiculously in Charge. And we want to talk more about how we get to that clarity, and particularly some advice for leaders on how we communicate focus and vision and what that looks like, you know, in the workplace, so that we can allow our team to create and be prosperous and be successful. And we'll talk more in a moment, Dr. Henry Cloud, in just a moment, his latest book, our discussion today on Connecting Faith. You're listening to Connecting Faith, talking today with Dr. Henry Cloud. You've hopefully read some of his books. I hope all of them. Boundaries for Leaders is the new one. Results, Relationships, and Being Ridiculously in Charge. But I'd recommend Necessary Endings, Integrity, excellent book. The One Life Solution, The Law of Happiness, 9 Things You Simply Must Do. There's a lot of resources there that can really help you, not only in your business life, but your personal life and your spiritual life as well. Henry, we want to talk a little bit about how does a leader bring that focus and vision and clarity to an organization without maybe squelching the creativity, or just, you know, having the right kind of approach and attitude?
Well, it's a good question, because some leaders, you know, they'll have this really controlling kind of top-down authoritarian, you know, command and control way of leading, which actually does squelch people. I mean, we know that now from studying people's brains. And it's very, very important that a leader do two things at any level in an organization. But the first one is that they really have to know what they're about, and to get it defined very simply. You know, if you take, I just did a leadership thing with the CEO of Southwest Airlines, and it was so amazing how simple and clear. Talk about getting an organization simple and clear. He says, "Here's what we do, and everybody knows it. And here's the line: we connect people to what's important in their lives." Now, if you're a gate attendant, if you're selling a ticket, if you're a flight attendant, you've got so much clarity about what is today about. I am about connecting people to what's important in their lives. And so you're going to treat it as important. You're going to try to make it work. You're going to get it done. And the way that they go from there is you set people free in their own roles and responsibilities to figure out the how-to. And what, you know, and this is so important when it comes to the brain. And what we're talking about, Neil, is not just a big company like that, but we're talking about even the way a family as a team works. You know, I think it's just really important for a family to get together and say, what is our purpose? You know, what is a family? What do we want our mission statement to be like? What are we trying to build here? What's our vision? And even do that, we've done that before, you know, in talking about a vacation. Okay, what's our vision for the vacation? What do we at the end of the time want to be able to look back and say, this was amazing? What would make it amazing? And then you figure out, what everybody's role is going to be to pull that off, what's going to drive that result, and then everybody's got their behaviors and we hold each other accountable. And, you know, that's pretty much the way the brain works. And if people would run families and companies like that, you get good results.
You know, we talk about the right approach and attitude. I know you share in the book, just even from your personal experience in the past, discovering that the wrath of Henry was having a negative impact on your team. You know, I would think that it's a challenge maybe even for dads or for, you know, leaders in general, that, you know, we don't maybe realize the kind of impact or the way that our attitudes are, what we project, is being received.
Yeah, that thanks for bringing that up. I really appreciate that.
Sorry.
It's a story I tell in the book, though, and it's particularly in the section of the emotional climate that a boss or a leader or anybody creates for another person in terms of the brain. Basically, if somebody feels under threat, you know, some kind of toxic dynamic that feels, you know, threatening in some way to their personhood or how they feel about themselves or, you know, whatever it is, when the brain goes into threat, then the higher functions of the brain actually shut down, you know, like creativity and problem solving and you know, goal orientation, all the stuff we want people to be doing, right? But when we feel threatened, the what's called the lower brain activates, and that's a fight or flight brain. And so it secretes all these hormones to activate you to fight or flight. And because the last thing you want to be doing in danger is thinking, right? If you're on a train track and you hear the train horn, you know, you don't want to sit there and start calculating how much does the train weigh, how fast is it. No, you want to dive off the track. And so when we put people under threat, and sometimes it's with anger or our tone or shaming them or whatever, then what happens is it really decreases their brain functioning. If you do that with a kid, if you do it with a spouse, if you do it with somebody you're leading or if you're their boss, it's going to decrease their ability to actually to give you the results that you're asking for. And so what that story was, was I, in our company one time, I walked in the controller's office and asked for some report. She said, "Oh, I don't have it. It's down in somebody else's." And I said, "Oh, I'll go get it." She goes, no, don't." I said, "Why?" She said, just don't. I'll do it." And I said, "Well, why?" She goes, I'll do it. And I could tell there was something she wasn't saying. And so I said, "Why don't you want me to go down there and get it?" And she said, "Honestly, because you'll just go down there and cause a bunch of trouble, and then I'll have to be hand-holding the rest of the afternoon and putting people back together." I said, "What?" She goes, "Yeah, that's what you do. You know, if you're bugged about something, you kind of walk in and you're sort of, you know, gruff or whatever it is, and it upsets people, and then they come up here, and she goes, "I'll get it." I said, whoa. You're telling me that I upset people like that? I mean, I was clueless about this. And she goes, "Oh, yeah, we even have a term for it." I said, "You have a term for it? I mean, you know."
That's the worst, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like if it happens once, fine. But if it's often enough where they have a term for it, you're in trouble. So I said, "Well, what's the term?" She goes, "We call it the wrath of Henry." "Don't do that. You'll get the wrath of..." I go, "Come on. Are you kidding me?" And she said, "Really?" So I had to go down there and, like, talk to everybody and say, "Is this true? What do I do?" And listen to them and apologize, because that's the last thing that you want people to feel like, right? It's just terrible.
One of the things you talk about is you give an example of Tony Dungy when he went to Tampa Bay to be the NFL coach there. And just a reminder that, you know, we can't always control, you know, outside circumstances and influences. But so how do we have maybe the right kind of climate and culture even when circumstances aren't going our way? There's, you know, a Wall Street collapse or whatever it might be.
Yeah, that's one of the most important things that a leader can worry about, because every leader is going to find themselves in some context that forces outside of their control are affecting them. You know, if it's Wall Street and the market is just crashing, and or you're in the real estate business and the mortgage market is dead, and or if you're Tony Dungy, what the story I told in there was the story he tells about when he went to Tampa Bay. And they had lost 14 seasons in a row when he first went there. You know, he was inheriting a team that had lost 14 years in a row. And so he starts asking everybody, you know, "Well, why can't you guys win a game? And he said, they basically said four things. Well, our stadium's too old, fans don't like it, and, you know, we can't have all the facilities we need. Or they said the second thing was, we don't have any star players, and we don't have enough, you know, a team doesn't have enough money to go hire some superstars. The third one was, well, we live in Florida, and we never win in cold weather. And the fourth one was that some voodoo lady had put the Doug Williams curse on the team because he was their last winning quarterback. And when he left, she cursed the team because she got mad at him. And so he's looking at these things that everybody always gives as the excuses. He goes, none of these things are in their control. And so he did what every great leader does. He gets people to begin to see the things that are 100% in their control that are connected to results. And then you begin to get people to work on the things that they can control that will affect results. And so he isolated three. He said, you know, he looked at all the stats. He said, winning teams don't always have the star player or the best stadium or, you know, live in warm weather or cold weather. The winning teams, when you get in the stats, they have the lowest turnovers, the lowest penalties, and the best special teams. And so that's what he began to work on. He goes, we have control of this. You can hold on to the football. You can not fumble it and not throw it to the other team. You can also not get penalties. Just keep your head about you. Don't break the rules. And the third thing is they could focus on their getting better on their punt returns and kickoff coverages. And when they began to focus on the behaviors that they could control, then they changed the result when the external circumstances were the same. And that's really a challenge for any of us in any of our lives.
Yeah, I mean, whether it's business or personal, too, isn't it? I mean, there's a lot of personal application there. Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, I talk to my kids about it all the time. You know, I've got a 10 and 12-year-old. And they'll come home and talk about, you know, well, this girl did that, and this kid did that, and this, that. And it's a great lesson. You're right. There's going to be people that are really, really snitty, and they're mean, this, that, and the other. So given that, what are your options? What can you do? What do you have control of that's going to affect this outcome? And it's a lesson we learn, hopefully, early in life. It's kind of the, you know, the fruit, the spiritual fruit is called self-control. There's no fruit of other control. We wish we could, but we can't. And all we can do is control ourselves. And once we realize that there are specific behaviors in any context that do affect outcomes, then that's what we focus on.
So does it go back to, even as we touched on earlier, about some of the brain research that we attend and we inhibit, I mean, and keep current? Can we actually apply some of those things in these kind of situations?
Yeah, we can, and it's very important to do them in tandem. You know, we want to be attending and focusing on specifically the things we have control of, and you want to be inhibiting all the other things that get in the way, and you want to do that every day. You know, I was just at Elevation Church in Charlotte doing I did a Boundaries for Leaders simulcast there just yesterday. And they have this staff challenge that they do every now and then. It's a 30-day challenge. And they have identified four things that everybody has control of that directly will affect their how healthy they are and how good they feel. Okay, so there's four things, and you have total control of these. And so for 30 days, you get 1 point for each one. For 30 days, they have this contest, and you get 1 point a day for each one of these you do. So the first one is exercise 30 minutes today. The second one is stay away from all, you know, the list of carbs that are bad. The third one is no sugar. And the fourth one is your spiritual disciplines. Okay? So you get 1 point for each of those behaviors. See, those are things totally in our control. And when you get people realizing what is in my control that I can do every day that's related to the goal I want to reach, and then I attend to those things, I inhibit anything that would get in the way of those, and I have a current, you know, a working memory. In other words, I keep it in front of me, and that chart's up there, and I'm going to do it every single day. You will get results because your brain can do that. It can follow that. You know, if you're really going to create results as a leader, one of the most important things that you can realize is that you have to lead yourself. You know, the higher you go in leadership, basically, the less direction you get from above you, right? I mean, all the way, if you take the highest position in any organization, for example, it would be the CEO. And the CEO does not really get direction. What they get is they get a board that they're accountable to that gives them parameters, their policies. Usually it's a policy board that sets parameters. But the CEO's pretty much got to lead themselves. And so when you think about that, you know, it's true in a family, right? The parents, nobody's parenting them. They got to lead themselves. And so when you think about that, the boundaries that a leader has really that they set for themselves are absolutely crucial. And in the book I have, in that chapter, I have several of them. But let me give you just two real quickly. The first one is to have a very firm boundary against being a closed system. That anybody that is a closed system to outside input is going to get crazier over time. And they're gonna lose energy in what they're doing over time. You know, everything winds down in a closed system. And so these are the craziest families, they're the craziest people that you know, if somebody can't take outside input and they don't have people speaking into their lives and giving them direction and modeling and coaching and mentoring, as well as putting energy into them. You know, we need encouragement at times, and we need to be pushed, and we need to all that stuff. So leaders must, as a discipline and a structure, figure out who am I going to be opening myself to give me feedback, bring reality to me, encourage me, support me. Where am I going to get that stabilization from the outside? And then the second one I'll just mention about the self-boundaries is boundaries on patterns. You know, where leaders get into trouble, or anybody gets in trouble really, is when they don't recognize the difference between a problem and a pattern. Everybody has problems every day. That's what life's about. You solve problems. But if you got a problem and you address it, okay, or somebody tells you about it and you address it, and then it happens again, well, you might not have a problem. You might have the beginnings of a pattern. And what happens with patterns is they begin to actually get hardwired. And once we have a pattern, like if a company, for example, misses a market launch date for something, that's a problem, and they figure out why they miss it and they fix it. But if they miss two or three, they don't really have a problem. They got a pattern, and once you have a pattern, you've changed your identity, because now it's in the DNA. That's who we are. So it's not like you're a company that missed a launch. Now you're a company that misses launches, and that's very different. And so leaders need to really become aware of what is recurring and go after patterns with everything you have.
Wise insight and advice from clinical psychologist and leadership consultant Dr. Henry Cloud. And as I mentioned right at the outset, I think one of my favorite lines from one of your books, I don't know if it's Integrity maybe, but this, what, the reality is always your friend. Isn't that what it is? Just say a word about that. Why? I mean, that seems like a good place to just hang on to no matter what we're experiencing.
Well, I think it was Woody Allen that said, reality may be, we might not like it, but it's the only place you can get a good steak. And, you know, as hard as we might be facing some reality, and as hard as it might be to look at and to embrace, if we don't, and we don't make friends with it and embrace it and meet it and do what it demands of us, then it will ultimately do us in. And so we either become friends with the issues in our lives that we have to deal with, or we try to avoid them, and then those issues are really going to be very strong enemies, and that they'll get us in the end. So it's very important to have, you know, the grace and the truth, that we've got to really, really lean into the difficulties that we find anywhere, put our arms around them and solve them, even if it may be hard. You know, you might have a cavity, and that's reality, but better to become friends with that cavity and take it to a dentist than to try to avoid it, because then you're going to end up with a root canal, and you don't want that.
Wise insight and advice from Dr. Henry Cloud, talking about his book, Boundaries for Leaders, Results, Relationships, and Being Ridiculously in Charge. And earlier today on the program, we talked about his new book, Never Go Back, 10 Things You'll Never Do Again. Dr. Henry Cloud, leadership consultant, best-selling author, and speaker whose books have sold over 7 million copies. He's our guest today on Connecting Faith.